Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing okay, Justin. How are you?
Doing as good as I can be.
Well, what better way to kick this off than to say we're back?
Hey, happy new year and all that good stuff. I hope you were able to survive a little bit of a hiatus from the Generation Y.
For those of you who are curious, we have a venue now for our Los Angeles, California meetup on March 24th. It'll be from 3 to 7 p.m. Pacific time at Idle Hour.
It's going to be loads of fun. We were trying to get a venue where we could do like a show and stuff, but LA is expensive. So you're just going to get to hang out with us instead. Tonight's case takes place in Fairbanks, Alaska, 1997. And it's a group of kids that get into some trouble one cold night. They're all teenagers, and I personally don't think you can really look at anyone in this case and think they were a perfect angel, but I wasn't a perfect angel either at their age, so I don't judge them on things that happened 20, 30 years ago. I only judge this case on the evidence. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight, we're talking about the case of the Fairbanks Four, and they were four young men who were accused of beating to death a 15-year-old by the name of John Hartman.
So Fairbanks, Alaska has a little over 30,000 people that live there. A lot of it is blue collar. I don't want to say that it's low income, but there's not a lot of opportunity there for all the population, especially the younger crowd, the teenagers. There's not a lot for them to do. So drug use and alcohol is pretty rampant. This isn't a knock against anyone that lives there. This is just what happens in any city, any town, where you don't have a lot of things for kids to do. There's one particular night that people like to go out and celebrate. Some people call it Wild Night because everyone in the town receives a dividend check for the oil and other industries around that area. So some of these people that are not very well off get a fairly large check. like a lot of people who aren't used to having any money or living paycheck to paycheck, when they get a check, they want to celebrate. Now, whether this is going out drinking, going out gambling, or just partying in general, also, everybody knows everybody's getting paid that same day. So the darker side of this is the criminals or opportunists will come out and try to steal checks from other people. They'll play pretty much the knockout game. If most of you know this, it was a internet phenomenon a little while ago, but you run up to somebody and you sucker punch them and knock them out and while you record it. Now, this is, you know, the late 90s. They're not recording this, but they're running up and attacking people in an effort to steal their money or get their check from them. This night is overwhelming for the local law enforcement. And on the night of October 11th, 1997, the police are so shorthanded that they're actually calling up other officers on their night off and asking them to come in and work. They can't keep up.
The Alaska Permanent Fund sends out dividend checks about every October. And this really all started in 1976 as an amendment to the Alaskan Constitution. And it's a really big deal for some people, people who are out of work or who don't earn very much money. At the time in 1997, the checks that went out for every Native Alaskan, which by their definition would be anyone who has spent a calendar year in Alaska. In 1997, that payout was $1,296.54. So you can imagine how that went over. There are a bunch of people out ready to party, ready to buy things, or as Justin mentioned, people ready to take this as an opportunity to get some free money. But this wild night brings out all kinds of people. And at the center of this case, really, is a young man by the name of John Hartman, who is 15 years old at the time. He was out with a friend named Chris Stone. What we know is he was actually wearing Chris Stone's pants. Chris Stone had these corduroy pants. They were very baggy on John because Chris was larger than he was. And I don't know. I know some people like to wear baggy clothes.
Back in the 90s, baggy pants were kind of a trend.
Now, Chris was known to be a drug user. He accompanied John Hartman out that night. But at some point, supposedly, according to Chris, they part ways. And this is really the start of this horrible night for John Hartman.
During the night, they're bouncing from house to house. And it is alleged that they're drinking and taking Wellbutrin. And at some point, John Hartman actually goes into a seizure or kind of flips out. He will tell people throughout the night that he's been taking Wellbutrin, and he'll tell people that he's been taking LSD. Now, skip ahead a little bit. Autopsy reports will show that he did not have LSD in his system, and they didn't even find the Wellbutrin in his system either. So lots of alcohol. That's all we can really confirm. But as most teenagers do, they like to talk up themselves. They like to act like they're doing something far more rebellious or cool than just hanging out and drinking. So that's sort of a theme, I think, that might carry this story along. But yeah, they separate ways at some point during the night, and John's walking home, we assume, but they're not saying they're going home. And they had been offered rides home earlier that they had turned down. So whether or not John was on his way home or heading somewhere else to party some more is sort of up in the air. But his friend Stone is the last person to see him alive.
Early that morning, and this is, what would you say, around 1:30 in the morning?
Yeah.
A woman by the name of Melanie was staying at a woman's shelter on 9th Avenue. And this area is in downtown Fairbanks. She is watching a show and she gets, I don't know, she reaches a point in the show where she's just not interested. So she steps outside to have a cigarette and she hears a smack sound. And this is kind of like, imagine someone getting hit or slapped on the skin. And then she hears a second smack, and then a voice saying, "Help me, help me." She could then hear what sounded like someone getting beaten. And then a second voice, older, who sounded drunk, with a native accent. So a native Alaskan accent. She also said this voice sounded very angry, but she couldn't make out what they were saying. She didn't call the police, but she did go down and speak to the person that ran the women's shelter and told them what was going on. So they stepped outside to listen to see if they could hear anything else, but they didn't hear anything.
And they didn't really see anything either.
Because of where the sound was coming from, she could tell it was coming from a relatively busy street. So she figured, okay, well, they're not calling the cops, but someone driving by will have seen something. And if someone down there needs help, they'll get help. Someone will stop. So that's at about 1:30 in the morning. And then Calvin Moses is driving Louise Lambert and her sister home, and they noticed someone lying half in the road. Louise, when she looked at the person lying down, like they were on the ground, she said it looked like a little boy stretched across the curb and into the road. That's how she described it. He was still breathing, and they know that because it was really cold out and they could see his breath coming out, but he was bloody about the head. Louise noticed that his pants were down towards his knees, his corduroy pants, and they left to get help. They didn't want to stay there and try to get help because they were nervous that whoever had attacked this kid may have still been in the area. It was actually less than 10 degrees that night. I think it was about 8 degrees. Paramedics got there very quickly. They noted that his pants had been pulled down. They noticed that because of the way he was moving, that he had suffered head trauma. And they could see evidence of that as well. So they did another test where they shined a flashlight in his eyes and his pupils didn't dilate. So that looks really, really bad. The people that stopped and discovered this young man, that was at 2:50. So between the time that Melanie over at the women's shelter heard something, what sounded like an attack to her, and then the time that people actually stopped to help who had seen this kid lying down on the ground, it was an hour and 20 minutes. So that's a long time for someone who's been brutally attacked to be lying there in the road. So they rush this young man to the hospital, and he is put on life support.
Now, during the night, another teenager named Eugene Vent has been out celebrating and partying. There is a hotel that a lot of the kids like to frequent, the Alaska Motor Inn. And a lot of underage teens will go there and drink and party. And the owner of this hotel, or the manager that's on the night shift, he's calling the police and saying, "Hey, you have kids that are out of control here." But being the night that it is, the cops aren't real receptive to out of control kids. Even when he tells them there's underage drinking, still nothing happening, until he says one of these kids brandished a firearm and threatened him with it. Well, that doesn't happen a lot in Fairbanks, apparently, and the cops are there pronto. But this is not until much later in the morning. His first calls were probably around 3 a.m. The cops, they pick up Eugene, who is really drunk. He's, I think his blood alcohol was 0.158, so double the legal limit. And he's underage, so there's really no legal limit for him. And the hotel owner says, "That's the guy that threatened me with a gun." So the police arrest him. They do not find a gun on him. And it's never exactly proven if he was the actual person that threatened the hotel owner, or if he just happened to be the lucky teen that got pointed out that night.
Well, I think given the lack of evidence here, you might just assume that the reason why there was a gun brought up at all is just like what you were talking about. He couldn't get the cops to come out, and he was at his wit's end. These kids were partying it up and
trashing the place.
Yeah, it was just too much for him. He was done. He was past his limit, And I think the gun was simply brought up because he was a desperate man at that point.
Yeah, it's very possible, because I don't think Eugene actually had a gun on him, because this just is going to sound bad, but a drunk teenager isn't going to be smart enough to ditch the firearm when the cops come arrest him. That's just not going to happen. He would have still had the gun on him at the time of the arrest. They bring in Eugene for questioning, and you got to understand that he is wasted out of his mind. He is 17 years old, and he's been arrested now and brought in for questioning. You can imagine how well this goes. Hours and hours where they would allow him to sleep for a bit, and then they'd go wake him up again and continue the questioning. What were the types of questions they were asking him, Aaron?
The detective that was interviewing Eugene was Detective Ring. And he starts off by asking him if he'd like a parent present. And Eugene's like, doesn't matter. I'll be 18 next month. So more of a, hey, I'm an adult, just talk to me. And then they read him his rights and let him know that he can have a lawyer. He doesn't have to talk, but they would like him to, of course. He starts off by asking Eugene about the gun. He said, you know, is it a toy gun? Is this a real gun? And Eugene responds, I didn't have any gun at all. Then they ask him about the trouble on Barnett Street. And he seems confused. He doesn't seem to know about Barnett Street. So Detective Ring insists that he knows something about it and brings up one of his acquaintances, someone by the name of Harley, someone that Eugene knows. He says, you've already told them, you know, I mean, Harley's already told us about what happened at Eagles Hall and at Barnett Street. Eugene's like, well, Harley can say whatever he wants. Now, he says, you've already been identified with a gun. You got in a fight at Eagles Hall, and then you got in a fight at Barnett Street. And so Eugene asks him if it's by the Alaska Motor Inn. And it's really from here, you get the sense that Eugene starts to sort of try to answer Detective Ring's questions or respond to his accusations, but they're not on the same page at all.
Eugene's thinking one thing about his night, and the detective is asking about something completely different.
And, you know, we could get into the interrogation technique that Detective Ring and Sergeant Kendrick and some of these other law enforcement figures use. It's the Reed technique. And it's really coming from the place of, we already know everything. So to make it easier on you, you just need to tell us what happened. You can confide in us. And the more you tell us, the better it will be for you.
Just fill in the blanks.
Ring asks him who he was out with. And he says, I was out with my friend Conan. He said that he and Conan went to Eagles Hall. And after that, Eugene left and went alone to the Alaska Motor Inn. And this is where it gets really confusing, because you have to understand, the detective is coming from a place of, we have a 15-year-old who got beaten almost to death, who's on life support, may not make it. And they have picked up this guy who was really drunk and who was already identified by the manager over at the Alaska Motor Inn as having been involved in some things and already had a gun. So now they have this dangerous person. They're trying to connect him to this Barnett Street attack. And so Eugene starts telling him about Michael Ludenbacher, who was wanting to buy weed from him. And Eugene makes it sound as though he wanted to sell weed that night, but Ludenbacher was acting tough and was getting on his nerves, so he didn't want to deal with him. So there's this whole story about how he told Michael Ludenbacher, you know, just page me later, I'm going home.
Again, obviously not on the same page at all with the investigators. Ring keeps asking him about a fight, and he's referencing his bloody shoe print, and he keeps referencing it, and Eugene has no idea what he's talking about.
Yeah, Detective Ring tells him that they found his shoe print in blood at the scene on Barnett Street. So Eugene says, well, if they say I was there, I guess I was there, but I go all over downtown. And he's like, no, you were there where this attack was. You were in a fight.
There's blood on your shoes, and your shoe print was in the blood on the street. And at that point, Eugene looks down at his shoes for blood, And the detectives tell him, don't bother cleaning it off. We already know. But this was them reaffirming this with Eugene, a drunk 17-year-old, over 15 times before Eugene says, well, maybe I was there.
Yeah. And then Eugene, though, he's thinking about this and he says, if I was in a fight, I would have bloody knuckles. And then Detective Ring responds, not if you used a tire iron or something like that. And Eugene said, no, I don't use stuff like that. I use my bare knuckles.
And again, John Hartman had been beaten and stomped to death. So this isn't lining up. But they say he's pretty much confessed here because he's like, well, maybe I was there. Sounds like I was there. So they're going down that avenue. They feel like they're breaking him now.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
And since he keeps bringing up this fight, Eugene keeps thinking of Michael Ludenbacher and thinking he must have gotten to a fight. But he wasn't there to witness it, so he doesn't know anything about it. He doesn't even know where it might have taken place. Ring is trying to get him to talk about Barnett Street, and Eugene just isn't getting it. So Eugene starts telling him he's tired. Ring tells him that his friend is in the hospital, and he's hurt real bad. They don't know it yet, but the young man is John Hartman. He was 15 years old, and whoever attacked him beat him and stomped on him. So, you know, he may not make it, and Eugene is concerned. He wants to know who it was. He's like, I don't know of any friends who got hurt. So just tell me who it is. Give me a name. And the detective says, well, he didn't have any ID on him. We don't know his name. That's why we're talking to you. You need to give us his name. And Eugene says, I wasn't there. I don't even know who this would be. So just give me a name. Give me whatever you have and I'll try and figure it out. Basically, I mean, he just doesn't know what the detective is talking about. So now Eugene is starting to get really frustrated because he's saying, you don't believe me. And I've already told you everything I know. So why should I keep talking? That's what he's basically telling the detective, because the detective keeps saying, don't lie to us. We already know this. We already know that. You just need to come clean with us. So then Ring asks him after a while who he was with at 9th and Barnett. Now, remember, Eugene doesn't seem to know about this area, and he's only admitted to being there because supposedly there is forensic evidence showing that he was there.
A bloody footprint.
Yeah, which seems pretty conclusive, right?
Yeah.
So Eugene says, Williams, Ludenbacher, and me, and Dana Anden, who is Conan's girlfriend. Now, he says Conan stayed at the hall, Eagles Hall, which is where there was a big dance there because of a wedding, I think. But Williams and Ludenbacher are the two people that he was around that night, mostly because he was trying to sell weed. So Detective Ring wants to know how they got from Eagles Hall to 9th and Barnett. And Eugene says that they walked. They start going round and around about Harley again. Supposedly what had happened was at some point, that was one of his plans that night, was to meet up with Harley because Harley owed him $25. So he wanted to collect. Detective Ring keeps bringing this back up, talking about Harley, because supposedly Harley got maced. And so they're looking for confrontations here. Were you involved with this? Were you there when this happened? And Eugene isn't getting it. He still doesn't know what he's talking about. And he's trying to tell the detective that he never ended up meeting with Harley. And the detective's like, that's not true. You're lying to me. So the frustration gets worse. He's like, you don't believe anything I say. I've already told you all I know. What more can I say or do? He starts asking Eugene more questions about the different people. Eugene responds by saying, well, why don't you just go talk to that person? To me, as the interview is happening, it's not really going anywhere, but the detective already has it in his head. And this is very evident. And wouldn't you agree, Justin, that he believes that Eugene was involved in this attack?
But there's zero tying him to it. He was picked up because he allegedly threatened a hotel owner with a gun. He wasn't picked up for a fight. He wasn't picked up because he was identified at being at the scene of the crime. None of that. They're just pulling him in and then questioning him about another random act of violence that happened.
But it really seems like, and this is something we've heard about many times, is they'll say, oh, as soon as they talk to this person, they fixated on them and they never got off of them. So that's why we ended up with this person being convicted. This is one of those times where this is absolutely that. Like, I've debated in the past with other people about different cases and whether there was a suspect or a person of interest who was focused on and you know, to the exclusion of everyone else. This is it. This is so apparent that this detective is going after him for this attack. But Eugene just isn't getting it. He doesn't understand what this detective is talking about. And it's really apparent.
I think that if they were trying to investigate who could have beat this teenager, he should have said, hey, did you happen to be at this street and this street during the night? Yay or nay? Do you happen to know anyone that got into any fights tonight? I mean, more general questions. Because they're diving right in, they're not getting anywhere. And I don't even know why they fixated on Eugene. A lot of people will say, well, it's because, you know, he's a native Alaskan. There's racism. They just do this to anyone that's of, you know, more of an ethnic descent. But I don't know. It's so weird that they fixated on him that night because there was nothing tying him to this scene.
Eugene was picked up early that next morning after the attack. And as I said, the detective is really focused on him, really feels like he's connected somehow. So as part of that interview, if you want to call it an interview, they get names.
They get a lot of names that night. He's been telling them about all these random people he's hung out with and hasn't hung out with. So which names are valid and which ones are invalid? Which ones pertain to the murder? Which ones don't? Really, it's anyone's guess. And we're playing like throw a dart at a dartboard with names on it. And we'll just start picking those people out. But something interesting happens the next day. His friend George Freese makes a visit to the hospital. He's hurt his foot or his ankle. He's disheveled, like probably most teens in this town after the wild night. They say, well, what'd you do to your foot? And he alludes that he got into a fight. And the nurse, who happens to be a nurse that's been working on the other boy that's dying upstairs because he's been stomped to death, says, well, are we going to see the other guy you got into a fight with? And George says, nah, you're probably not going to see him. This sounds really bad because they know that the dying teenager was kicked and stomped.
And now you have another kid coming in who has a foot injury and is talking about being in a fight.
Now that to me is a total red flag. I'm not saying it's enough that you need to cuff him immediately, but this makes more sense.
This is a lead.
Yeah, this is someone you should talk to. Now he's there at the hospital. He's planning to get an x-ray done because he feels like his ankle or his foot might be broken. So the detective is talking to George. George, right from the beginning here, says that he doesn't remember anything. Now the detective doesn't give up. He continues saying that it may take some time for him to be able to talk because he knows that he might feel some shame or this is just a lot to deal with, that he's had a long night. But George just keeps saying he doesn't remember. Over time, Detective Ring, who is the one interviewing him, is getting more and more determined to get information from him. And in fact, if you were to read through the transcript, you'll see that most of what is said is by Detective Ring. I mean, George hardly says anything. This is really just Ring running at the mouth, just constantly talking and telling him things. And then George saying, I don't know. I don't remember. So then Detective Ring has George's girlfriend get his left shoe or boot. They just want, you know, they're going to have a Sergeant Kendrick take it to see if they can match it against the print that is on the skin of the victim. And George doesn't seem fazed by this, like, whatever. So they take it. The detective says, you know, you're having trouble talking about this. You're having trouble remembering. What if I were to drive you to where the crime occurred? Would you be okay with that? And George, he seems agreeable to it. So the detective takes him.
And I just want to add this in real quick. It's really interesting to me to see these young guys who party, get into trouble, be so respectful and cooperative with law enforcement. I mean, not to say that they shouldn't be, but there's no attitude here. There's no, I'm not going to talk to you or anything. They're actually pretty willing and open with law enforcement and agreeable, really.
So George is taken to the crime scene. Then they come back. George Freese ends up mentioning Vernon Roberts as a name of someone who was there. Now, there meaning, I guess he's trying to appease this detective because the detective is very insistent upon, you know, you were at this scene where there was this terrible beating. This visit to the crime scene didn't help him, though, because he's still, most of the time, he's just saying, I don't remember. The detective starts pressing him, assures him that he should remember, especially since he injured his foot. So they kind of get into how he injured his foot. And according to George, he had kicked the ground, and that's how he injured his foot. But the detective is working him and saying, you know, there's this kid that got badly beaten, and you must have been there, and that's how you injured your foot, right? Well, eventually, George says, well, he might have kicked him a couple times, and then that third time he was going to kick him again, that's when he kicked the ground. And then he went down because it hurt so bad. So now at this point, if you're just an objective person, this is very suspicious. Not only did he start by saying, you probably won't see the other guy that I fought with, but now he's saying that he kicked somebody a couple times. And then the third time he went to kick them, he injured his foot. And that's why he's at the hospital. This is a red flag.
It looks really bad. Is it this guy's absolutely the one that did this? We don't know yet, but it sure sounds like he was in an altercation the night of where he was kicking somebody.
Because of the detectives having already talked with Eugene, now they're starting to try and put together a picture of who could have been involved in this. I guess you could say their biggest piece of evidence, at least in terms of trying to put together people, you know, in one place, is a picture of a basketball team. And the four people who had played, I believe three of them were official players. The fourth one was academically ineligible, but they were George Freese, Eugene Vent, Marvin Roberts, and Kevin Peace. These are the Fairbanks four. And this is what they're going to start using to try and get these people to talk. by saying, hey, these are your buddies. You were out with them, right? Well, when they asked George about Eugene, he says, I only see him every couple months. I don't see him that much.
These guys are friends, but they're not best friends.
So now George is getting really frustrated and he starts cursing and he says, get it in your effing head. I don't remember, because the detective is telling him, hey, I know you were there. I know you were involved. You were kicking this poor kid. And he doesn't remember anything, he says. So he's just really tired of talking to this detective. He continues to curse in response to this detective. So then Detective Ring says, don't treat me without respect. And George doesn't even want to respond to that. He's still really frustrated. Now he's cursing even more. He's everything is F this, F that. George actually says at this point, he says, get me a hypnotist or something. I don't remember. In other words, bring someone in who can pull the truth out of me because I've got nothing. Now, at this point, Detective Ring leaves the room and George Freeze, while he's just sitting there, says, I want to go home.
I want to leave. Yep.
This is significant because he's being recorded. So it's not as though no one hears this.
This is equivalent to asking a police officer, am I being detained? Am I under arrest? And if you're not, you get to leave. But the detective, he acts like he didn't hear that, right?
At this point, Sergeant Kendrick walks in. He's basically saying, you know, Detective Ring had spoken with you earlier, but you were having difficulty remembering things. So I'm in here to try and help you out. Let's talk about this. What I like about this part is Sergeant Kendrick actually asks him, what were you doing? Let's talk about where you were. So George tells him that he was at Crystal's drinking at 11:30 p.m. or so. And Crystal's his girlfriend. The sergeant asks him, well, where were you at? And he says where they were.
These kids are jumping around from house to house. So they're trying to pinpoint their location to see if it was close to the murder scene.
He keeps referring to Marvin Roberts as Vernon. And I found that some of the people involved in not just this case, but in that area have other names. Maybe they have preferred names they go by, but they started with different names than the ones they currently use.
Yeah, they got their nicknames.
Then he says that after a while that he and Vernon walked downtown. They walked. And that was about at 1:30 in the morning. So then the sergeant suggests that he might have gone to Eagles Hall because a lot of people were going there. And George says, most likely, but he doesn't remember. So you can imagine that this sergeant is getting more and more frustrated just the way that Detective Ring was.
But he's giving him leading questions. Oh, I'm sure you went here. But he's not allowing the suspect to give him the answers. He's feeding the answers.
So Detective Ring at some point interrupts to say that he will be talking to Marvin Roberts as he has a car that matches the description of a car seen at Barnett Street. Well, everyone knows that Marvin Roberts has a car because most of these people that are involved in this case, they don't have cars, but Marvin Roberts does because he worked as a wildfire firefighter. He would earn pretty good money. So he was driving a blue Mercury Topaz.
And as a firefighter, especially in Alaska, you have to travel great distances. So he had to have a vehicle, I'm sure.
Now, Sergeant Kendrick wants him to describe what happened at Barnett Street. All George will tell him is that he kicked the person a couple of times and that Kevin Peace kicked him first. So now he's kind of bringing in someone else. And he goes back to saying he doesn't remember anything. So then the pressure becomes greater and he's being pressed for more information on the attack. He just says, you know, he hurt his foot. And he agrees it was after kicking the victim and that the third kick actually struck the ground. And that's what hurt him real bad. And he went down. During the later part of the interrogation, he agrees to himself that it was Eugene, Kevin, and another guy. So it doesn't seem like Sergeant Kendrick is very successful at getting out of him who this other guy was.
Then something I just want to point out is all of the people that George has named that night are completely different than all the people that Eugene has named that night. There is zero correlation between their two stories, and there is zero continuity between their two stories, between the facts they've given. There is nothing relatable between their statements.
Kevin Peace is interviewed. Detective Ring reads him his rights and tells him he can have a lawyer present. But Peace is just willing to chat with him. Kevin Peace is 19 years old.
Again, these teenagers are pretty open, at least in the beginning, and respectful of law enforcement until it doesn't go the way anyone wants it to.
Detective Ring asks him about Eagles Hall, and Kevin says, wasn't ever there. Then he asks him about the party at Alaska Motor Inn, and Kevin responds, wasn't even there. So this does sound suspicious, right? I mean, the detective is asking him questions. He's like, wasn't there, man? Wasn't me.
Yeah. It's one of these things where you can think, well, he knows something's up, so he doesn't want to place himself at anywhere there is a problem. Or the other side of it is, he really wasn't there, and he's being totally honest.
Detective Ring asks him about a fight that happened at Barnett and 9th Avenue. And Kevin responded, I seen it on the news. So Ring says he knows that Peace was with Eugene and Marvin, and Peace says he wasn't. He was with his girlfriend, Jessica, at Fairview Manor. He says he went there about 11 or 12 o'clock and could not definitively state which apartment number or building. And that's, he explains to the detective that he's not been there very many times, so he can't give them a building. You know, he starts by saying, oh, I think it was building D. But then the detective's like, no, it's buildings 1, 2, 3, and 4. And he says, well, I think it was 2. And he's like, well, that's the one that burned up. He goes, well, it must have been 3 then. So it's not working out. It sounds like a horrible alibi, right?
Yeah. I might even think, dude, this guy's lying. Like, he's not able to tell what building or apartment. But on the other side, like the other teens, could have been drinking, could have been out of it. Isn't familiar with the place because he doesn't go there that often.
Yeah, it actually wasn't his girlfriend's place, and she just happened to be there. And I don't think this is the kind of guy that was paying attention to where he was at. She was probably meeting him outside, and then they were going in together. That sounds like an excuse, but as we talk, I think it'll become clearer. Now, he tells the detective, well, just ask her. You can talk to her. And the detective says, she's not going to lie for you. Kevin says, well, she doesn't have to lie. She's not going to lie. She'll just tell you the truth. And the detective says, well, don't depend on her. So then Kevin asks for a lawyer. And Detective Ring says he understands that because he goes, I know you're lying. So I know you want a lawyer because you've got nothing for me. You're just going to keep lying. That, of course, gets Peace a little upset. And then the detective asks Peace about the blood that's on his shirt. And he says, that's mine. I had a bloody nose. And then he's asked about the 15-year-old kid that was beaten. And he says, I wouldn't beat up a 15-year-old kid. And Detective Ring says, but you beat up your mom.
Because there was a disturbance call earlier that night or the night of, where there was a disturbance at the house where Kevin and his mom got into an argument. And now the detective is asserting that he beats his mother when there was no evidence of that. It was just, hey, there's a big heated argument. The cops are called. But meanwhile, you got to realize that Kevin asked for a lawyer and the line of questioning doesn't stop. That's all I really need to know at this point myself. I think everything that he said should be thrown out at this point.
So Detective Ring insinuates that Peace sexually assaulted the 15-year-old boy. Peace adamantly denies doing that. Remember, this is after he had already asked for a lawyer. It's sort of like the detective is digging in at him. And this is all because of the boy's pants being down near his knees. So then Peace denies being there, says he would have run away if he was guilty of attempted murder. And Ring said, don't worry, I'll be interviewing Jessica and her parents. And Kevin says, why do you have to interview her parents? And he said, yeah, I'm interviewing her and her parents. And he says, whatever. That's the end of the interview.
So went nowhere.
Well, it depends. I mean, according to Detective Ring, he probably feels like he has three or four people already lined up because they're not talking, but they know something. Now, Marvin Roberts, we've already established he has a car. And in this case, the way the police are looking at it, there was supposedly a car scene. They figure that these kids would need a car to get there. So Marvin Roberts is definitely a person of interest here. They interview him. Robert describes hanging out with some friends named Daniel Huntington and Angelo Edmond. And they go to a dance, which we assume is at Eagles Hall.
There's a wedding reception, big old celebration.
And then after that, they go to the Alaska Motor Inn party. Now, breaking this down, he says that they were at Eagles Hall at about 11:30. And then he and Dan went to Eagles Hall. And then they met Angelo at Eagles Hall where this dance party was. The detective is trying to figure out where he was that night because he was driving around. So he wants to know more information about going there with Dan. He's like, where did you pick Dan up? And he goes, well, I picked him up at Eugene Vent's house. This, of course, is very interesting for the detective.
Because he's got a tie-in now to his first suspect.
Yeah, so now he's like, well, okay, was Eugene there? And Roberts is telling him, no, he wasn't there at the time. Well, where was he? And he said, I don't know. Neither of us knew where he was. Then he says that while they were at the hall, they heard that someone had been jumped outside, had been attacked and robbed.
Which I'm sure that actually happened. There were multiple muggings and attacks that happened that night. John Hartman just happened to be the most heinous and fatal.
So then he says that they left the hall about 3:30 or 4 a.m. and went on to a party at the Alaska Motor Inn, and they got there between 4 and 4:30. The detective is like, wait a minute, what were you really doing in between that time? Marvin said, well, we were really cruising. So he didn't have a specific time to give him because they were cruising. And according to him, they were looking for girls.
But his timeline is very loose.
Roberts is asked about his car and he says he's had it for about 2 years and that he gets people asking him for rides all the time. And Sergeant Kendrick comes in and says, you don't seem like the kind of guy that would be involved with people who beat the daylights out of a guy. And Roberts responds, no, I'd probably be breaking it up. That's pretty violent.
He's a good kid.
Sergeant Kendrick tells him that Eugene has implicated George and him in this crime. And Roberts says, give me a lie detector because I wasn't there. And he admitted seeing Kevin, Eugene, and George during the course of the night, but denied hanging out with them. In fact, he said that Kevin never asked for a ride. Eugene and George both asked for rides, but he turned them down because they were drunk. And he didn't want to give a ride to anybody that was drunk. And so Kendrick says, why would they implicate you then? Why would they do that? And Roberts says, well, maybe to get out of trouble. But he said he would never do that himself. Then Detective Geyer suggests that Roberts is kind of a victim since he was just giving rides and this all sort of happened without his, you know, prior knowledge, trying to get him to open up a little bit like, you know, hey, we can see how you might not have known what's going to happen. You're just giving people rides and then they get out of the car and then there's an argument or something and then it goes downhill from there and you didn't know what was going to happen and you didn't know what to do after. To really drive this home, Detective Geyer tells him that they have tire prints and suggests that when they look at his tires, he's like, why would they match? In other words, we're going to look at these two and when they match, like they already know they will, then you'll have no reason to say you weren't there because Roberts keeps denying that he was ever over there. Now, word comes in while they're talking that the boy that's on life support isn't going to make it. He's going to die. And so now the detectives are really, really putting pressure on Roberts, but he doesn't give in.
This is that moment where they're like, well, this just turned into a homicide.
They start telling him it's proven your car was there. And Ring comes back in and starts in with, this boy was sexually assaulted and insinuates that Roberts knows something about this. And Roberts keeps saying he doesn't know anything about this. The detectives aren't giving up. And the detectives now are using this, you didn't know what was going to happen. They're saying the others have already talked. They've already told us what you did that night, what you were involved with. They said you're only minimally involved. So if you just tell us what happened, we can clear all this up. Roberts is getting really upset and he's saying, I'm innocent. I'm scared because I'm innocent. And he tells detectives to talk to Dan and Angelo. And they say, we already have.
Of course they have, right?
Mm-hmm. So despite the enormous pressure on him, Roberts maintains his innocence and actually says, you know, he really hopes that boy pulls through. He's going to pray for him.
Well, that's what any murderer would say, right?
Well, I don't remember the others saying that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the interesting thing about Marvin's story for the night is that he was at this dance hall where this wedding reception was going on. And there are multiple people that witnessed him there at around 1:30, which is the suspected time of the murder or the attack. None of these people are questioned by the investigators. They will come up later in court. So he really does have a pretty solid alibi.
The detectives have also pulled his record up, and there's really nothing to speak of there. Minor consumption. He also admits to having a speeding ticket, I think, but that's it. So of all the people that they've been looking at, these Fairbanks Four, he's the one with really nothing to speak of on his record. And I think they're trying to use him as, hey, you've never really been in trouble. Why get yourself in trouble now? You can help us out. You'll be in a better place down the road. So this all went down in October of 1997, October 11th. On October 12th, these four are arrested. As I said before, they had all played basketball together, and it was a picture of them all together that the detectives had that they were using to kind of show, hey, we know you're all friends. We know you would probably all back each other up. Also, after this all went down and they essentially have confessions from two of the Fairbanks Four, they end up talking and they all agree that they are going to fight to clear their names and they won't take any kind of deal. They're going to stand together on this.
And again, they're friends. They know each other. They're on the basketball team. I'm sure they do look out for each other, but they're not that tight. And for them to come together and say, I think something screwy is happening here, let's not say anything, let's fight this, it's a little telling. And I was always wondering why they were twisting these four together, especially Marvin, who had the car. And I just assumed, well, so what, he has a car. But there was another witness named Arlo Olson, who claims to have seen another attack from a distance and all the attackers jump into a car and take off. And I think that's really the icing on the cake for the investigators to wrangle these four teens up, because they needed a car and they needed the attackers. And this all fits together perfectly for them.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Let's kind of go over the time here. October 15th, 1997, a grand jury brings down charges of murder for the four. And in 1999, there will be three separate trials. So they'll have two separate trials and then one trial for two of them at once. What we'll do from here, though, is we just want to kind of take you through what the evidence was, how that pertains to this whole question of innocence here, because it would take 10 years from the time they went to trial until the Alaska Innocence Project got involved. And I think in this case, it starts off with questions about racism, questions about whether the investigation was done well, because when you say that someone committed murder, the next question is how do you know that? And in this case, it's really simple. We have the detectives questioning these young guys. They're straight up telling them, we have your shoe print in blood there. We have your shoe print on their face, on the victim's face. We have your car placed at the scene. We have a witness that saw you four there. But what do they really have, Justin?
Well, this is where I really went into this case. I was literally biased looking for all the reasons why these guys are guilty. I wasn't even looking at the investigators' overzealousness. I wasn't looking into anything wrong with the trials. I was merely going for, why are these guys guilty? Because the prosecutors and the investigators still to this day swear up and down they got the right guys. So I thought, well, they must have some compelling evidence here. The boot print. Well, first off, there wasn't a bloody shoe print anywhere on the street. So they were straight up lying to Eugene, and police are allowed to lie to you and say whatever they want to you during an interview or pretty much any time. They're allowed to lie to your face no matter what. The boot print on the victim's face compared to George's shoe print, well, the investigators take a picture of this and blow it up and have it as like a transparency during trial, and they match it up. But like a lot of things, there isn't a scientific technique here. This is just eyeballing it, kind of like bite mark impressions. You know, sometimes they look okay, but for the most part, there's nothing scientific here.
And if you alter an image enough, is it really what you started with anymore?
Not exactly. You had the blood on Kevin Peace's jacket. That was his blood. He had a bloody nose. And he's a teenager, so he doesn't wash his clothes like he should. There wasn't any tire marks. The witness that says he saw them there taking off in a car was 450 feet away in the middle of a cold night. And I think the guy wanted to help, but now he's not so sure what he saw. And now he's listed as a witness for the Innocence Project, meaning his story has changed. So what do we have is what you asked me. That would be George making a offhanded comment in a hospital room about, oh, you should have seen the other guy. And you have Eugene saying, well, I might have been there because if my bloody shoe print was there, I might have been there. I wouldn't even call those confessions. I thought that they actually said, oh, yes, I was there. I absolutely did it. But when you read their statements, that's not exactly how it goes. And they offer Eugene and Marvin deals. Hey, you only serve a few years, maybe 5 years, if you tell us what happened and you turn evidence on the other two. And they turn these deals down. Offered 5 years or life sentences, pretty much. I have a really poor opinion about plea deals. I think plea deals only help the guilty and they screw the innocent, but these guys turn the plea deal down. So what do we have? I'd say a lot of nothing.
Arlo Olson, it turns out, was pretty far away. He was standing there looking over at this attack. He was 450 feet from the scene. And then he was also drunk and high. I'm not sure he makes the best witness. And I think that's really how that developed, was he was being assured by law enforcement, by prosecutors, that he was really helping to solve this crime. And I think that's where this started. But then later he realized that this was a big mistake. I dug as much as I could because I thought surely somewhere there is something that we could really point at and say, well, here's something to look at. This is why maybe one or more of these guys was involved in this attack on John Hartman, who ended up dying within 30 hours of his attack. But all I could find was that at one point, Eugene Vent told a detective that he might have given the victim gum, and they found a small pack of gum at the scene. But this is something that is pointed out as being significant.
Well, they told Eugene, your bloody footprints there. So you had to have been there. And Eugene says, well, I must have been there if you found my footprint. Well, who gave him the gum? Maybe I gave him the gum. I don't put a lot of stock in this gum statement, because you can't put any stock in some of these other statements. Just because there happens to be a pack of gum somewhere. I mean, there's so many leading questions, so many statements about this. I don't put a lot of stock into it. It's not a smoking gun to me. It might be to other people. But if three or four guys are pummeling another dude, you would think that there would be a little bit more physical evidence there besides some random stick of gum.
Yeah, it's said that there was no leading statement in regards to the gum, but I have a problem with this whole gum thing, because if you're going to attack somebody, why would you offer them gum, right?
It just doesn't
feel right. It doesn't make any sense to me. They also point out that George Freese, during his so-called confession, is the one who comes up with the story of how John Hartman was beaten to death. They say that was his doing. He's the one who came up with that. He described how he was attacked. But if you actually read the transcript, he doesn't give a detailed statement. He says that he might have kicked him twice. And then the third time he kicked, he struck the ground. That's not a very good description. A good description would be, it was myself and these three other guys. We approached the victim, exchanged some heated words. We jumped him. This guy attacked him first. Then I did this. And then there was nothing like that.
It was, maybe I kicked him twice and then I kicked the ground the third time. That is the false confession that people are looking at. Now, whether you say that's a real confession or a false confession, those are the words he used. And when DNA evidence started exonerating people, and the first 200 people exonerated, up to 16 to 20% of them that were exonerated on DNA evidence had given false confessions. So that's between 32 and 40 people said, I did this crime. And that's people that signed statements saying, I brutally murdered or raped or whatever, gave graphic details, who have been exonerated. But this guy says, I kicked him twice and kicked the ground. This is the confession?
See, to me, he never names the victim. He never is conclusively linked to this victim. He's merely saying that he kicked someone a couple times. I mean, he could have kicked the ground in another incident. We have no idea, but it just doesn't feel legitimate here.
Actually, later on, he'll say that he was wrestling with a friend, somebody totally unrelated, and that's how he hurt his foot. So, yeah, he might have kicked the ground and his friend and whatever when they were wrestling, but I don't know. It's just really weak. And I have to say that when I first read his statement in the hospital, I was like, whoa, that does not sound good at all. But then I think back, John Hartman was telling people he was taking LSD that night, and that wasn't true either. They were saying they were on drugs. They were saying they were doing this. Oh, you should have seen the other guy. I really think that this is just teenage boys trying to sound cooler and more hard than they really are.
All you need to know about these trials that occurred was that it really rested on the woman who heard the cries, who was staying at the women's shelter, and then Arlo Olson, who witnessed some other guy being attacked by what they determined was the same group of boys that attacked the other kid. So you're talking about two attacks that night by the same group, and one of them ended up in murder.
Now, when it comes to Arlo's statement, do we even know if he actually saw anything? I mean, here's the problem. He says he saw an attack from over 450 feet away and can recognize people. But I'm wondering if he saw an attack at all, or if he was just trying to be helpful. People do want to be helpful, especially when something as serious as a murder happens in their hometown. You know, they're told, oh, we already got these guys. We already know who they are and what they did. We just need you to tell us that you saw it. And if you're ever told that by an investigator, well, if they already have them, they don't need your statement. I'm not trying to tell you not to talk to cops. I'm saying that if you didn't see anything, you don't give them anything.
Yeah, if they can talk people into giving false confessions, why couldn't they talk people into giving false witness statements? Are you sure you didn't see this? Because this would really help us.
Yeah, it happens all the time. Arlo and some of the other witnesses will be told that, oh, we already have other witnesses that place them there. We just want more ammo here. Now Arlo's the only guy on the stands saying he saw anything.
So let's be clear. Every bit of evidence they collected, they tested, and nothing connected any of these four men to John Hartman. And we've already spoken in the past about witnesses who, I mean, how reliable are they? Well, you take someone who's drunk and high and 450 plus feet away. I mean, we established the distance because luckily a detective measured the distance, which I think is awesome because that helps.
But then they decided to take the jurors out onto the street in the middle of the day and do a little experiment, which that doesn't work because it's the middle of the day and everyone's sober. So yeah.
Yeah. I would have liked if they had brought them there at 1:30 in the morning, really high, really drunk, and then had them watch a scene 450 feet away and then describe it later.
That would be a more relevant test.
It would be more relevant. Yes. Yeah. Anyway, the prosecutors are successful. They get convictions for each of the four. We've already described how shoddy this whole case is. At some point, and we're talking within 10 years here, the Alaska Innocence Project enters the picture. And they make an agreement with Marvin Roberts and George Friese to investigate their case. So they start going through and interviewing everybody. And one of the people I think they find that's very significant in 2012 is William Holmes.
William Holmes hasn't been mentioned at all during this entire night. They don't know him. Nobody's friends with him. But William has a very interesting story. William happens to be serving time for an unrelated crime. He doesn't know the Fairbanks Four from anyone, but he remembers a beating happening that night on that street corner. And he's willing to sign an affidavit and swear to it.
Yeah.
Now, he doesn't know these guys. He has no connection here. And he's gaining nothing from this statement. He's saying he knows what happened that night and who really killed this boy.
William Holmes was a drug dealer. He started with pot. And then he says at some point he was robbing a house and he found cocaine and started dealing in cocaine too. He wasn't much into gangs or anything like that. He was his own boss and he made up his own rules according to him. And one of the people he ran around with was a guy by the name of Jason Wallace. Now, according to Holmes, he said that night they were driving around and they were planning to beat up somebody. And he said it's something they would do. But I think they indicated they were going to beat up a native.
These guys are looking for Alaskan natives to go rough up. That's their pastime. They're bullies. And it's pretty racist, too, when you think about it. This is wild night, too. So I don't think this would have stood out too much to anyone. And apparently it really didn't because the cops weren't called until hours after the beating has alleged to have occurred.
According to him, he stops the car and Jason Wallace, Rashawn Brown, Marquez Pennington, and Shelmar Johnson jumped out and attacked John Hartman. He said that it was Jason Wallace who face stomped him. And that's why he believes that Wallace is the one that actually delivered what would be the killing blows.
I saw an interview with the Fairbanks Four when they were incarcerated. They were asked if they knew Holmes or any of these guys. And one of them said, yeah, actually, I've heard of Holmes. I've met him, whatever. He's like, I don't like him. We don't get along. So for them to not even get along, what is Holmes's motivation to clear these guys?
Well, according to the naysayers, they would say that Holmes is already serving a life sentence, so he's just screwing with the system.
At this point, when he's come forward, anyone that's familiar with the case could have given as much information as Holmes, sure. But for him to come forward and sign an affidavit, it's mind-boggling to me that he would want to associate himself with this crime. And it's mind-boggling to me that the justice system wouldn't want to vet his story when they don't have much evidence with their current guys. You would think that the vetting of the evidence would happen before you're having to prove it in a court of law. But in this case, there wasn't any vetting, and they didn't really need to prove it in a court of law because they got their guilty convictions anyways.
And since we're going over the evidence and how they tested it and they couldn't find anything linking the suspects to the victim, I also want to address the whole accusation of sexual assault on John Hartman. Now, remember, when they found him, he had his pants down around his knees. And early on, we talked about how he was wearing Chris Stone's pants. And they were corduroy pants. They were very baggy. It's very possible that since he was in a fight and he was being attacked, that his pants just came down during the attack. A rape kit was conducted on John Hartman, but there was no evidence of sexual assault. But remember, the detectives are insinuating that there was a sexual assault, and they were asking these guys, did you do this? Or do you know anything about this? And they kept denying it. Well, it turns out that from all available evidence, that John Hartman was never sexually assaulted.
2012 is when William Holmes comes forward as a witness and says that the murder was by four of his friends. And then in 2014 is when Arlo Olson has recanted his statement. But the brother of John Hartman, Chris Kelly, he was told by the prosecutors, we got the right guys. And Kelly will even visit these guys in prison. One of the Fairbanks Four says, I'm sorry, I didn't know that was your brother. And of course, Kelly takes this as an admission of guilt. But this statement to me is very vague. I'm sorry, I didn't know it was your brother. Does it mean, I'm sorry, I didn't know I killed your brother? Or does it mean, I'm sorry, I didn't know your brother was the victim in this case? And if you're the brother of the victim, I know which way you're going to take it, because your heart, your soul, your emotions are very much invested in this. And the prosecutors have been telling him, we got the right guys. So what else is he to believe at this point?
The summer of 2015, Marvin Roberts is released on parole. Also in 2015, due to the efforts of these witnesses coming forward, you have Arlo Olson, who recanted his testimony. You have William Holmes, who's coming out and saying, I know who did it. It's these guys over here. When the court took a look at all of this, they decided that a jury in 2015 probably wouldn't be able to convict these men. There just isn't any evidence. It really shows you how this case was built around Arlo Olson. That's really all they had. I mean, it's one thing to lie to a person that you're talking to and say, we have your blood at the scene. We have all these people that saw you there. You know, your friends have already turned on you. That's great for your little interrogation. But when it comes to a court of law and things are on the up and up, they didn't have anything on these guys. So December of 2015, a judge vacated the convictions of the four men. Now, what happens is they create a deal. And what they say is, we're going to dismiss your convictions, okay? And you're going to go free. But you cannot sue any governmental entity involved in this case. As part of this deal, they have to get Marvin Roberts to come back in and agree to the deal because he's already out on parole. He's already free. So they can't use the "we'll let you go" thing.
Yeah, because they're actually saying we're going to vacate your conviction, but this takes time, 6 months to a year. But if you want out right now, will you have to agree not to sue us?
So, of course, these four take the deal and they're all released. Justin already brought up Chris Kelly, who's the brother of John Hartman, and he was pretty upset about this. And he's trying to see it from every angle. He's saying, if they're innocent, if you believe that all of a sudden now, I don't see why you could even justify doing this to them. And if they're guilty, I don't see how you can justify making a deal. So in other words, if they didn't do it, then why did they put him through all this stuff? And why are you saying that you cannot sue? Because you've literally lost 20 years of your life just about. And then if they are guilty, why are you cutting them a deal? They murdered somebody.
To Chris Kelly, welcome to the true crime genre, because this is the inconsistencies that we look at and analyze every day. And just like you, bud, I'm confused and flabbergasted myself.
Arla Olson, who had recanted his testimony, who had been instrumental in getting convictions of the four originally, he died by taking his own life in prison in July of 2017. The Fairbanks Four have now all filed lawsuits.
But they said they wouldn't sue. It's not that simple, is it?
And this is something that we've talked with people about at length, which is when you've been wrongfully convicted and then the state comes to you and says, okay, we'll let you out, but you can't do anything back to us. They're essentially saying they can do all sorts of harm to you and nothing will ever be done about it. And I know there will be people who say, well, but they were freed and now everyone knows that they weren't involved. That's not true. We've had people writing in, some of them pretty serious, saying, I think they did it. Okay. I still don't see the evidence of that, but there are people that still believe that they're murderers. That's not just going to go away because the state cut a deal. Sometimes people think, well, they bowed to pressure. There's concern of racism here or insensitivity to the Native Alaskans.
It's political.
Yeah, it's a political move, right? So you've already tarnished their names. Now, I know you could point and say some of these guys were already doing criminal activities, whatever, but let's be honest. You can't just convict someone because they may have committed a crime at some point by convicting them of something that you don't even know if they did. Just because you've committed a crime once doesn't mean you can peg them on something else later that they didn't do. I mean, there's no evidence here that they were involved in any way with the death of John Hartman. If you just read through the transcripts of the interviews that the detectives did with these four, I think that should be pretty convincing in and of itself that they worked really hard. As the detective said, he's like, we've been at this for 16 hours. We know what we're doing. We know you were involved. This was really just, let's just get this solved and move on.
I truly have gotten to the point where I feel that in the court of law and in a trial, innocence or guilt has zero to do with anything. And it's all about who makes the better argument, who fought more, who got the better experts on the stand, and innocence be damned. In a case like this, prosecutors can say, well, we did everything right, so you can't say that there was any wrongdoing. Even if they're innocent, we charged them according to the letter of the law. We didn't do anything wrong. Therefore, there's nothing to be said, done, and we cannot be held accountable for people that get themselves locked up.
This is a very dissatisfying case because there's no evidence to show who committed this crime. There's no evidence to suggest that they'll ever be able to get the responsible parties because we still have the prosecutor saying we did the right thing. We had the right people. This doesn't make any sense to me. It's as though the death of John Hartman will continue to be without justice. And I think that's a terrible thing. For the people that supported the Fairbanks Four and witnessed them come out and rejoin their families, there's a small victory there. But really, at the heart of this, there's a young guy that lost his life on a night where he thought, hey, I'm having the time of my life. His life was cut short, and there's no one to hold responsible for this. The people that they had convicted, their convictions are taken out. William Holmes, despite coming out and saying, I know who did this, these are the guys you want to look at, two of them aren't even in prison. Prosecutors can't use William Holmes's affidavit to prosecute anyone in this case. They just don't have the evidence. We already said that they tested all the evidence that the Fairbanks Four had, and nothing ties them to this crime. So they have nothing in addition to that. They have nothing that suggests anyone else at all.
And they even question Wallace, saying that he had immunity. He wouldn't talk about it. He wouldn't say that he remembered anything from that night. In every case, I can never definitively say, oh, I know exactly what happened, because I wasn't there that night. I wasn't there at the scene. Aaron and I just collect the evidence, analyze it the best we can. Can I definitively say the Fairbanks Four did not do this? No, but could I definitively say there is anything tying them to this crime? No, I can't. When you look at beyond a reasonable doubt, I actually don't know how these jurors found them guilty. I just, it does not make sense to me. So obviously they were underrepresented. The prosecutor held all the cards. Whether or not the prosecution did anything wrong, I don't know. But when these guys are found guilty on the charges and lack of evidence that they had, I can't think that the system and the process worked correctly.
And for those of you who are wondering about the effectiveness of eyewitness testimony, just ask yourself, would you feel comfortable having a man who is legally drunk and really high and witnessing something you did from 450 feet away.
Over a football field.
Giving testimony against you. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.